We've talked about mutation and migration and genetic drift. We've also considered natural selection to a fairly large extent. We've talked about gene exchange. We've talked about the evolution of cooperation. We've talked about endosymbionts. We've talked about the evolution of virulence. What happens when you bring together a cooperator and a defector? Not necessarily good things for the cooperator. Many of these ideas will be gathering together into this chapter into one coherent theme, considering in particular the evolution of greater size and complexity in microorganisms. And not just microorganisms, but larger organisms as well. We all come from microorganisms, and in fact, every life cycle for most organisms, larger organisms, we return to the single-celled state before we initiate the replication that leads to the formation of our macroscopic bodies. The rules that are necessary to assure cooperation among cells that are microorganisms, among cells that make up microcolonies, are very similar, if not identical, to the rules that are necessary to assure cooperation among the cells that make up multicellular organisms. Another issue in going from single-celled to multicelled is what can be described as a transfer of fitness. In a transfer of fitness, we go from the unit of selection, or the primary unit of selection, being the individual cell, to the unit of selection being instead a group of cells. Or alternatively, in the social insects, the primary unit of selection being an individual animal, going to the primary unit of selection being a group of animals, that is a hive. So, cell associations and groups may persist and reform with varying likelihood depending on properties of the group and the component. So here, persistent reform basically means reproduce, and the component individuals. Initially, group fitness is the average of the lower level individual fitnesses, but as the evolutionary transition proceeds, group fitness becomes decoupled from the fitness of its lower level components. Indeed, the essence of an evolutionary transition in individuality is that the lower level individuals must relinquish their claim to fitness, that is, to flourish and multiply, in favor of the new higher level unit. This transfer of fitness from lower to higher levels occurs through the evolution of cooperation and mediators of conflict that restrict the opportunity for within-group change and enhance the opportunity for between-group change. In other words, you have less evolution going on within the individual in terms of the cells making up the individual, for example, and more evolution going on between individuals. This would be a between individual multicellular entities, for example. Until eventually the group becomes a new evolutionary individual in the sense of being evolvable, possessing heritable variation in fitness at the new level of organization, and being protected from the ravages of within-group change by adaptations that restrict the opportunity for defection. So these adaptations are similar, if not identical, to the ones that we've already been discussing. And when you have defection going on within a multicellular individual, unless this is defection from without, this defection among the cells making up that individual, we would describe as tumors and cancers. So we have some trait, some allele that gives rise to an increase in these things along the top versus another allele found at the same locus that gives rise to this here. So what we have at the bottom here is fecundity, and at the top here is something else. Fecundity really is kind of equivalent to expediency, and these other things can be viewed as kind of equivalent to economy. Fecundity also can be viewed as more or less equivalent to defection, whereas these upper things can be viewed instead as cooperation. So first of all, in order for there to be an evolution of some larger group, there has to be some compelling reason to be larger and or more complex. If there isn't a compelling reason, then the various things that are going to be selecting against being larger and more complex will be more compelling than those things that in fact should select for it. So you're not going to get the evolution of larger size and greater complexity unless there's some utility associated with larger size and greater complexity. And the compelling reason is that big things or complex things can do things that smaller things cannot do. So if there's a niche that can be exploited by being larger or more complex, that is a compelling reason to be larger and more complex. One of those compelling things at a lower level may simply be for the individuals making up this larger being to survive. For example, there might be protection from predation that's associated with grouping together rather than not grouping together, or being larger versus being smaller. At higher levels, you have properties that individuals are able to collectively attain that individually would be impossible to attain. And so, for example, ingestion by animals, where they're taking food into their bodies where it's then digested, is an example of something that an individual cell would find it difficult to do. Of course, individual cells are able to display phagocytosis, but that's not quite the same thing. But as we'll see, there is some connection between phagocytosis and ingestion. But alternatively, large things are harder to sustain than small things. And as a consequence of that, the fecundity associated with small things may be higher than that of large things. Small things can grow faster, they can replicate sooner, and that can give them a generation time advantage over larger things. On the other hand, as noted, larger things may be able to fill niches that are not available to smaller organisms, and that can be a compelling reason to grow to larger sizes, even though there are costs to being larger, and one of those costs is in terms of replication rate, fecundity, or generation time. So this is looking at the transition among the vulvocene algae from single-celled organisms to very complex multi-celled organisms, Volvox. In these larger organisms, one of the things they solve by being larger is having a differentiation of cells such that you have some cells that have flagella and others that are responsible for division and also responsible for the production of the gametes. And part of the thing driving this is that cells can't swim and divide at the same time. So by having flagellated cells that retain their flagella and other cells that are replicating, you can have replication going on at the same time swimming goes on. And again, swimming is something that is useful for the sake of probably obtaining resources from the environment. In this case, it would be light resources. In addition, you have differentiation where you've got cells that are responsible for generating the gametes, and these cells are in fact not responsible for maintaining the organism, dividing to create this large colony, or for that matter, they're not flagellated cells that are used for swimming. And so what you have are at least three different types of cells. One of them can't divide but can swim. One of them can divide but can't make progeny, that is a new Volvox, new multicellular algaes. And one of them is able to make these new multicellular algaes, which are basically the germline. Now you see the same kind of situation here. Now this is a colonial canoflagellate. Now colonial canoflagellates can either be viewed as the most primitive of sponges or a complex type of protist that is closely related to the sponges. What you have here are what in sponges are described as collar cells. You have microvilli that form these collars, and the whipping around of the flagella within the collars draws water through the collars and therefore food particles into the collars. The food particles get trapped in the mucus associated with the collars, and then they're drawn down towards the mouth of these cells and phagocytized. One of the things that I realized in the course of just looking at these things one day is that while we've got these collars that consist of microvilli, recall that the surface of the cells that make up the surface of our small intestines also are covered with these microvilli. And the microvilli increase the absorptive area of these cells. In the sponges, these collar cells are the cells that obtain the food. So they're the ones that actually are taking in food inside of the individual cells and then digesting that food. Well, it's not that different. It's not that much of a transition to go from cells that are responsible for capturing food and then digesting it to cells that instead are responsible for excreting digestive enzymes and then capturing the products of the digestion via the same cell surface features as you see here, the microvilli. So instead of having the food go in and then get digested, the food remains on the outside, the digestive enzymes are excreted out, but the microvilli remain, and they are now the site, rather than of chunk of food capture, instead of the site of digested food absorption. But back to our story, we have basically these canoflagellates represent the sister group to the animals, the metazoans. These colonies are found on stalks, which likely serve as a means of thrusting the feeding cells into the currents where the food particles are found. This is consistent with the ideas that we've talked about with regard to microcolonies of bacteria being long and jutting out into the currents, again, to capture, in their case, materials that are dissolved in the currents flowing past them, versus materials that are not dissolved, which is what these cells are, the canoflagellates are capturing. But you also have multiple cells at the end of a single stalk, and this means that on a per stalk basis, or on a per acquisition of a site of attachment to the substrate, the surface upon which they're growing, you have, instead of just a single cell, you can have multiple cells, and that means that more progeny, that means that more nutrients can be acquired, and presumably more progeny can be produced per site of attachment to some surface. In addition, similar to the Volvox, you've got cells that can't divide and also maintain important functions at the same time. With the canoflagellates, they can't obtain food and divide at the same time. You can imagine their division messing up temporarily this collar morphology. So in addition to having more cells attached to the surface and more cells therefore per stalk, you also have the potential for these cells to help each other out so that while one cell is dividing, another cell can be gathering food and supplying that food to the dividing cell. That way cells don't have to give up on nourishment just to divide. And this presumably allows these cells to grow at a more rapid rate than would be possible as individual cells, which in fact do have to make a trade-off between division and their replication. There's another interesting similarity between these colonial canoflagellates and sponges, and that is that with sponges you also have these multiple cells, and the cells feed other cells. In the case of sponges, they're not necessarily feeding other collar cells, but instead feeding other types of cells that are found in the sponges. But in the colonial canoflagellates, you've got cells that are feeding cells, and they're able to feed other cells, in this case cells that are going through a division process. And in fact, one of the cells that are supported by the collar cells in sponges are in fact the cells that go through the division processes. So this is a hypothesis as to the origin of animals. If we started with a single-celled organism, then that organism could form into a colonial form, which then can, or evolve into a colonial form, which then could give rise to a hollow ball of cells, which in turn can give rise to a ball of cells that in fact is invaginated. And right here what we see is basically the form that most of the animals take on. All of the animals really, except for the sponges. This solid ball of cells is essentially equivalent to our marula stage during embryonic development, during the embryonic development of animals. This hollow ball is essentially equivalent to the blastula stage of embryonic development. And then this hollow ball that is invaginated is equivalent to the gastrula stage of animal embryonic development. So why do we become bigger? Well, we've talked about this. There's a potential to avoid predators. There's a potential for greater motility. There is a potential for keeping the interior of your ball of cells at a slightly different chemical or physical state relative to what's going on outside of the colony, and thus some primitive level of homeostasis can be maintained. For example, you might be able to increase the concentration of some sort of food stuff that you've been gathering up in order to have it serve as storage in the interior of the ball of cells. Who knows? But at any rate, you have this also potential for there being a greater number of cells found at the end of those stalks that we saw in a previous slide with the colonial canoflagellates, where basically you have a fairly large number of cells that is attached to a fairly small area of surface on some kind of substrate, like a rock found at the bottom of the ocean. And so what you have is various advantages that may be associated with being larger, consisting of more cells, than being smaller and consisting of only a single cell. Another advantage that we talked about, of course, is the ability of cells to transfer food, nutrients from one cell to another, so a cell can continue to have nutrient supplies while it's dividing, if in fact it can't gather nutrients at the same time that it divides. Now, why become a hollow ball of cells? Well, the answer is that you can become larger still without having to either invest in creating cells in this interior or having to feed the cells that are found in this interior. So you can be relatively larger based on the same number of cells by being a hollow ball rather than being a solid ball. With more cells on the exterior, we have more cells that are capable of gathering up nutrients and also more cells that are capable of contributing to the movement of the colony of using flagella. Now, a next step is the differentiation of these cells into more than one type, such as a germline versus somatic cells. So the somatic cells can be the cells that are responsible for gathering up food. They can be the cells that are responsible for the movement of the colony, and they may be able to supply food to these reproductive cells. In fact, if you've already got a situation where you've got cells that are gathering up food that are supplying food to those cells that can't gather up food because they're reproducing, because they're dividing, it's not that far a step to have cells that are differentiated such that they never are responsible for gathering up food and are always dependent upon the food gathering cells for their nutrient needs. A next step is this potential for, in fact, the colony to attach itself to a source of food that is found along some kind of surface. And you can imagine the ability of these colonies perhaps to produce extracellular enzymes that are capable of breaking down the surface in such a way that the material then can be taken up into the colony. If you had cells that were able to absorb directly across their plasma membrane at this point, then if you broke down these surfaces, such as surface biofilms, completely, such that they were absorbable nutrients, that would be an easy way to basically have this process occur. But it's difficult to imagine going directly from intracellular digestion to extracellular digestion coupled with absorption of the digestive products, rather than phagocytosis of the digestive products. So perhaps an intermediate state is the production of digestive enzymes that break down, for example, the biofilms found on surface into chunks that can then be phagocytized by collar-type cells that are found lining this infolding. And in fact, you could then have a more complete utilization of the digestive products if you had a combination of the uptake of the digestive chunks and digestive products that are absorbable. So conceivably, a more effective colony could be one that's both phagocytizing and absorbing. Perhaps the absorption could occur along the microvilli, and then eventually you could have a transition where you have simply absorption of nutrients rather than phagocytosis and also absorption of those nutrients without ever losing the microvilli that are associated with the collar cells. At the same time, you could have the exterior of these colonies taking up the task not strictly of nutrient gathering, but instead that of movement and also perhaps that of protection, where they are serving they can produce some kind of relatively durable extracellular coating that could protect the colony from being parasitized from the outside. In this next step, we have the formation of a digestive cavity via further infolding or further invagination. We again could have the cells that are particularly effective at gathering up nutrients on the interior here, and we could have a breakdown of surfaces in such a way that both chunks and absorbable products are produced. We could have both phagocytosis and absorption of nutrients going on in here. But with this cavity, we could also have the taking up of even larger chunks into an interior here, where you could potentially have more effective breakdown, extracellular breakdown of the food stuff. And again, it could be taken up by both phagocytosis and absorption, and then you could have a transition entirely to just absorption. Another thing that can go on is that you could have essentially a sponge larvae. So sponges are, what they do is they digest their food intracellularly following phagocytosis. The larvae are responsible for dissemination of the sponges. They're multicellular organisms in their own right. If the sponge was provisioning the larvae with yolk, and the yolk were provisioned into this digestive cavity type thing, or an archenteron, as we would describe it in during embryonic development of animals, then the yolk could very well be phagocytized, but it also is possible that the yolk could be more effectively utilized if it is in fact broken down extracellularly and then absorbed. And this provision with the yolk could allow the sponge larvae to disseminate further, and thereby giving the parental sponges an advantage over those that produce larvae that couldn't move as far. And then if you had larvae that were also capable of taking in chunks of food and digesting those, this could extend their ability to disseminate even further. And as a consequence, those sponges could have a further advantage over ones that weren't capable of this intracellular digestion. And it may be just a small step from there, where you instead have essentially sponge larvae that become the dominant form of the sponges, where you have sexual maturation of this form that in fact is capable of ingestion, and the sponge in a sense will have abandoned intracellular digestion entirely. So here we have a colonial canoflagellate. It has both cells that are able to gather up food and cells that are dividing. The cells that are dividing can be supported by the cells that are gathering up food. These guys are embedded within some kind of jelly-like matrix that allows the cells that are capable of gathering up food to be on the outside and not having a cellular interior that needs to be supported by those cells. So that makes these blobs more efficient. But they still have gaps between the cells, and if you want to increase the cell density and therefore the density of cells that are able to gather up nutrients, you can come up with what essentially is a hollow ball of cells. And in this case, what you have are also the potential for an exterior that perhaps has some potential to be protective against the invasion by parasites. And so you're going from essentially a single cell stage to a colonial stage that consists of what effectively is a solid ball of cells, to a solid, to a less solid ball of cells, to a hollow ball of cells. And then you also, you continue to have the cells that are dividing, the cells that are not dividing. Here we have not only that, but we have a differentiation into multiple cell types in the interior. And now we're getting to the point where we're really talking about the most primitive of sponges, or alternatively, an advanced form of canoflagellates that are actually displaying a cellular differentiation. You can have, for example, inside of here, cells that are responsible for the germline. You could have cells that are responsible for protection of a primitive immune system that, for example, could phagocytize by amoeboid-like action, perhaps parasites that have found their way in here. You, in sponges, you have a skeleton of sorts that is formed in this interior, and that skeleton is produced by cells that are found within the interior of the sponges. So you've got this potential for cells living in the interior that have specialized functions that are fed by the cells that are found on the outside. In addition, you can see the way they've drawn this, we have not just collar cells on the outsides, but we also have flagellated cells that are presumably responsible for a movement of the sponge. Now, we can then go to consideration of the evolution of non-sponge animals from sponge larvae, but first a little bit of recapitulation. So Margulis, and this is Lynn Margulis, that's also responsible for our endosymbiotic theory. Margulis proposed that the failure to solve the problem of simultaneous division and motility on a single cell level may have led in several groups to the origin of eukaryotic multicellularity. So this is something that we've talked about with regard to Volvox. With regard to the canoflagellates, we also talked about not just motility, but something that's related in the canoflagellates, their ability to eat, which also involves flagella. So you've got this driving towards having more than one cell type because a single cell can't do everything. And one of the everything it can't do is it can't do its normal functions and divide at the same time. So it's helpful to have other cells around that can help it out, that can supply nutrients to it, for example, while it's dividing. And then, of course, it can reciprocate and supply nutrients to other cells while they divide, while it, in fact, is capable of gathering up nutrients. The principal evolutionary step leading to the metazoan grade of organization, so metazoans are animals, is the establishment of this multicellularity where nutrients can be transported between cells. So you've got colonies where nutrients can be transported between cells, and you also have cellular differentiation. At the point where you have this cellular differentiation, at particularly where you have a germline that can produce gametes, can produce sperm and egg, you have transitioned from a colonial canoflagellate into a primitive sponge. Here we have sponge larvae. And the sponge larvae are showing increasing levels of sophistication. The sponge larvae are the motile stage of the sponge, the stage that the sponge uses to go from place to place. So a sponge basically is an organism that is not motile. It just sits in one place, but it produces progeny that are able to move about. These include the sperm that are produced by sponges, but also the sponges, once the sperm reaches an egg and the zygote is formed, they divide into this mobile stage called a larvae, just like we have larvae in many other animal types. Now, these larvae, if we have sealed epithelia, so epithelia is basically the surfaces of the larvae, if we have sealed epithelial, that these can allow for extracellular digestion because you can send digestive enzymes out of the cells, and you don't have the digestive enzymes moving back into the larvae, but instead you have the digestion of potential food things or yolk that then can be absorbed by the cells lining the interior of the larvae. But bidestive processes can only function in an enclosed space. As we noted, it doesn't have to be a completely enclosed space. It could just be a surface that you've docked against. But yes, if you're going to be in an environment that's very watery, that's well mixed, in order to efficiently digest outside of your cells with soluble enzymes, you're going to have to, in some capacity, have your tissues that are going to be responsible for absorption of the digestive products pressed up against whatever it is you're digesting. That's either that pressed up against a surface or alternatively completely enclosed by the tissues that are responsible for absorption by closing off the pore that leads into this invagination. At this point, we could describe this invagination as a digestive cavity, or instead as the equivalent of an archenteron, which is formed during the gastrulation step during embryonic development of most animals. So you've got this enclosed space, and it's formed by this invagination of this epithelium, and the epithelium is sealed so that it can't allow materials to simply diffuse into the interior, and it's also sealed in the sense that there's no way that the particles that are being digested in its interior, that the breakdown products of those particles easily exit out of this digestive cavity. So this could be the origin of the archenteron, where larger captured particles could be digested by enzyme secreted by the now existing endoderm. The endoderm is formed in the course of gastrulation, where you have the ectoderm found on the outside and the endoderm found on the inside. And whereupon the ectoderm is retained for the sake of locomotion. Alternatively, it's quite possible the ectoderm could have retained these phagocytic cells, these collar cells, so that you could have digestion going on both on the interior and on the exterior. And as I noted, you could very well have collar cells in the interior as well, and you could have those collar cells serving as phagocytizing cells, where the extracellular digestion is responsible for breaking down larger chunks of food into phagocytizable chunks of food, rather than necessarily breaking them all the way down to the point where they can be absorbed across the surface. And as I noted, you could have, instead of taking in food stuff from outside of the larvae, instead it could be yolk that's provisioned into the archenteron of these larvae that could allow these larvae to in fact move greater distances prior to them settling down and taking on a existence where they're in fact no longer able to move around. And as I noted, you could perhaps just have a docking and in some kind of infolding rather than invagination. And this docking could in fact be simply digesting of biofilms that are found at the point of docking, not so much for the sake of taking up nutrients, but instead for the sake of clearing a spot for the sponge to attach and then grow. And then this clearing process, which also can involve digestive enzymes, could then have been turned into not only breaking down of the clearant, the spot that needs to be cleared for the sake of removing it, but also for the sake of digesting the products that are generated. Again, this could be digestion simply for the sake of phagocytosis, and then it could be transitioned into for the sake of also absorbing the nutrients across the plasma membrane. So what ultimately is a sponge? Well, a sponge basically can be viewed as an elaboration on a microcolony. So just as bacteria form into microcolonies and they've got that extracellular matrix that's holding the microcolony together, and they are able to thrust themselves out into currents, and they're able to, as a consequence, absorb nutrients that are passing by in those currents. A sponge is an elaboration on creatures that have thrust themselves out from some surface into a current rather than to absorb nutrients, instead to phagocytize nutrients. But what then is a sponge? A sponge is simply a conglomeration of cells that, because of their sophistication, because of their cellular differentiation, because of the great size that they're able to obtain as a consequence of having an internal skeleton, and also this sophistication in great number of cells, they're able to thrust themselves further into the currents than can a simple microcolony, a bacterial microcolony, or a colonial canoflagellate. And as a consequence, they're able to gather up more nutrients through their phagocytosis, and they're also able to, therefore produce more progeny. In fact, they go even one step further than this. Not only are they passively picking up nutrients that are passing by them, but in fact, they're able to even pump nutrients through them, and as a consequence, pick up even more nutrients, even more food particles, as a consequence of essentially having even more water currents passing over their phagocytic cells than would be the case if they were simply sitting out there in a current picking up the nutrients from that current. It goes further than that. If you're a microcolony, you want to be able to disseminate your kind. You can have these cells that are able to mobilize, these swarmer cells, and move around, potentially finding new locations to establish new microcolonies. But if you're a sponge, in fact, you've got larvae, you've got multicellular organisms, multicellular progeny that are able to swim about and search and find new sites to colonize. And further than that, you may be able to prepare those sites. So even before you've laid down, it's possible that you could clear the biofilm that's already there and in fact establish yourself in bare substrate that you've cleared yourself. And in the course of this, perhaps you're gathering up nutrients. And these larvae, in some capacity, gathered up nutrients in a way that ultimately apparently led to ingestion. And with ingestion, you have this extracellular digestion rather than intracellular digestion. And thus was born all of the animals except for the sponges, the eumetazoa as they're described. Now the eumetazoa gave rise ultimately to ourselves. And we've got lots of themes that can be carried through with this multicellularity and this cellular differentiation. And one of those will be conflict mediation. How do you keep the cells making up these sponges, or the cells making up a bacterial microcolony, or the cells making up our own body from continuing to cooperate with one another rather than competing with one another? And that will be the consideration for the rest of this lecture. Key in the conversion of a group of cooperators to a new evolutionary individual is the evolution of conflict mediators. So what's a conflict mediator? These are genes that tweak development and/or the ways in which the groups are organized, and by so doing tilt selection in favor of the group and away from the level of the cell. Although the underlying mechanisms may be diverse, germlines, apoptosis, self-policing, mutation rate, determinant growth, reproductive mode, and propagule size, conflict mediation serves to enhance the evolvability of the higher level unit by restricting the evolvability of composite lower level units. However, the way in which conflict mediation is accomplished may be short-lived and end up interfering with the long-term evolvability of the new multicellular unit. So there are pluses and there are negatives to this conflict mediation. On the one hand, the conflict mediation is essential to keep the cells that make up a multicellular individual cooperating with one another and giving rise to the potential for the multicellular individual to reproduce. Rather than the individual cells simply reproducing at the expense of the multicellular individual. On the other hand, these mechanisms ultimately can have cost in that they can constrain the future evolvability of the organism. One place where we see such costs is in this determinate growth, where essentially each cell knows exactly what it's going to become, what its progeny are going to become in the course of development, rather than there being a developmental flexibility. And this results in what can be highly sophisticated organisms on the one hand, but also organisms that are relatively developmentally inflexible on the other hand. So an important conflict mediator is germline sequestration. This is particularly important in ourselves, that is in animals. We set aside cells early on during development that will be our sole reproductive cells, that is, will be the sole cells that give rise to our gametes, and therefore are the sole cells that are responsible for generating genetically the next generation. Of course, the somatic cells support these germline cells, and so they are responsible for an important component of the production of the next generation, that is the survival and ultimately the ability of gametes to find other gametes to fuse with, to fertilize with, to produce zygotes. But nonetheless, the gametes are responsible for the genetic propagation of the individuals, of the individual multicellular organisms. So for any other cell within a multicellular organism to contribute genetically to the next generation, it can't, but what it can do is assure that genetically identical cells, clonally related cells, in fact, do contribute to the next generation. This is essentially kin selection, but occurring within a single multicellular body. It's also inclusive fitness. So by a somatic cell supporting the survival and ability to reproduce of a germline cell, it is also assuring that the alleles that are found within that somatic cell, in fact, will propagate to the next generation because the alleles found in the somatic cell are identical to those found in the germline cells. So what we have simply here is the developmental process shown as the formation of new cells as a consequence of mitosis. And what we have is one cell giving rise to two cells. That one cell is the zygote, which is formed by, of course, the fusion of the egg and the sperm. So that's the first cell. That's our inner microorganism, as I like to describe it. And so it goes through mitosis. We have two cells, then four cells, then eight cells, then 16 cells, and so on. And what we see down here is that at some point there's the sequestration of the germline. So those cells that ultimately are going to give rise to the reproductive cells are diverted from production of somatic cells and instead are separate from the somatic cells, separate genetically from them. The somatic cells can't turn into germline cells after this point. So all of these somatic cells, in order for those somatic cells to contribute to the next generation, all they can do is assure that the germline cells contribute to the next generation. So if a somatic cell decides to cheat in some capacity, it's going to be cheating against the body as a whole, against the functionality of the body as a whole. And the consequence of that is going to be a lower potential for these germline cells to make to the next generation. So cheating as a consequence in most multicellular situations results in a loss of the survival, a loss of the viability, an inability to propagate to the next generation by the cheater genotypes. Now, there are some exceptions to that. So if you don't have germline sequestration, then in fact it is possible for the cheater cells to make their way into the next generation because they conceivably could give rise to germline cells themselves. However, this too can be minimized by forcing the cells that are going to produce the gametes to go through some kind of fitness test, essentially to make it difficult developmentally for these cells to make it through to the production of gametes, in the sense that if the cell is not sufficiently cooperative, if the cell is not sufficiently fit, if the cell is not functioning in the proper manner, it's not going to be able to produce the gamete cells, and therefore, again, it'll be lost from the gene pool. It won't make it into the next generation. So the multicellular organisms such as ourselves sequester our germlines, and this is a way of assuring the cooperation of the rest of the cells making up this body, of the multicellular body. And this is addition to making sure that all the cells are clonal, and by initiating the multicellular organism's body from just a single cell, that is passing through genetic bottlenecking. So the somatic cells, the soma, are dependent on the germline cells, the germline, for transmission of their genes, their alleles, to the next generation. Conflict mediation explicitly is a means by which multicellular organisms can prevent cancers. So what are cancers? Cancers basically represent cells that are displaying a lack of growth restraint. They are cheaters. They are cells that are displaying an expedient growth strategy so that they basically are displaying faster growth than is warranted by their environment. And they are able to, as a consequence of this excess growth, interfere with the functioning of the organism that they're growing within. And you can think of these as very much equivalent to a parasite that also is growing at the expense of the functionality of some host organism. In fact, the cancers can be thought of as the consequence of cheating from within, whereas the parasites can be thought of as consequence of what I've been describing as cheating from without. So what you have up here in the top row are basically cells that are just growing without any cheaters in their midst, a multicellular group of cells. It could be representing a multicellular organism such as ourselves. In the second row, what we have is a mutant, a cell that has mutated to some defector status, and the defection behavior is a degree of growth that is excessive compared to normal body cells. And you can see we've had a loss of symmetry here. We have the formation of what can be described as a tumor. We have potentially a loss of functionality of the multicellular organism. So these tumors can give rise to anatomical or metabolic abnormalities. But what tumors can't do in ourselves is contribute to the next generation. So a tumor can't spontaneously create a germline in ourselves, in animals, and from that germline give rise to gametes that are then able to fuse with other gametes in order to, or another gamete, in order to create a zygote and therefore the next generation. And this is in part because the germlines in animals are sequestered. And so the tumors form from somatic cells, and the somatic cells are barred from the germline, are barred from forming gametes. And so these defectors that form within multicellular organisms, unless they're within the germline, they can't contribute to the next generation. And this provides incentive for these cells, in fact, not to defect. And there are numerous mechanisms in place, both within cells and in terms of the immune systems of organisms, that serve to prevent cells from taking on this lack of growth restraint defector status, that is, becoming tumors or becoming cancer cells. It doesn't mean that these mechanisms are perfect, but they're certainly good enough to assure the continuance of lineages of organisms. In other words, the species tend to be able to reproduce, even though some of their members occasionally may succumb to cancer. So what's not going on here is there's not a random sampling of all of the cells found within a multicellular organism in order to give rise to the next generation. If that were the case, then these cancer cells could be sampled as well as cells that are going to contribute to the next generation. And in fact, they may be oversampled because they're displaying a lack of growth restraint, and as a consequence, their cell numbers are greater than they should be, and so they take up a larger fraction of the total number of cells within the multicellular body. And so if it was simply a random sampling of cells making up the multicellular body that gave rise to the next generation, they in fact would be increasing their fitness rather than potentially decreasing the fitness of the overall organism, which might be going on as well, of course. And this is very similar to what we talked about when we were considering within host competition within host fitness of parasites, where there's this incentive within hosts for a parasite to display more growth than, or faster growth than the rest of the parasites, because then they will make up a larger fraction of the total number of parasites within a host, and therefore potentially contribute more to the next generation of parasites, those parasites that are transmitted to new hosts, than the parasites that are not displaying this lack of growth restraint. So, by having a sequestered germline, you are preventing cancer cells, for example, from contributing to the next generation. In addition, as I've noted, if you've got fitness tests, basically developmental constraints on cells that are fairly rigorous in what they are demanding of the cells involved, before a cell in fact can produce a gamete, or before the gamete can be successfully fertilized and produce a viable zygote, if you have restraints at that level on the a potential for these defectors to contribute to the next generation, then even without a sequestered germline, you can also have selection against cheaters finding their way to the next generation. For example, we think about sperm and their tails and how they have to vigorously swim to make their way to the egg. If you've got a mutant that is not as effective in its functionality, just effective in its ability to evade growth restraints, then that mutant is not necessarily going to be able to swim as effectively, and therefore it will be selected against at the level of sperm swimming, for example. So if it were a function only of numbers, then this genotype displaying the lack of growth restraint would have a higher likelihood of transmission to the next generation. But because we've sequestered our germline, and because we've got policing that actively try to identify and eliminate cells that are displaying excessive growth, and because we also impose upon our reproductive cells certain levels of selection so that they have to be reasonably functional and reasonably fit before they can successfully contribute to the next generation, we've got a number of mechanisms in place that make it less likely that a somatic cell especially is going to be able to contribute to the next generation, contribute its alleles to the next generation if it takes on a cheater phenotype. And therefore, there's substantial mechanisms in place, selection in place, such that these somatic cells, in fact, display cooperative behaviors that have the effect of maintaining the functionality of the multicellular organism, and therefore the potential for that organism to contribute to the next generation. And so, in conclusion, if individual cells of a multicelled organism are not genetically identical, then the reproductive success of one cell does not automatically imply the reproductive success of other cells. So if one genotype is successful, a different genotype is not therefore also successful as a consequence of inclusive fitness. What you have instead is the potential for competition between different cells. If the cells are genetically identical, at least from an evolutionary sense, there cannot be competition between the cells because there's nothing for selection to differentiate. But once cells are different from one another, or once organisms are different from one another, once there are different alleles found at a given locus, then you have the potential for natural selection to act. Such situations destabilize cooperative behavior between cells. So ideally, if you're going to have a multicellular organism, that multicellular organism is not going to have genetic variation within it. An extreme example is a lack of cooperation displayed by pathogens or parasites towards an unrelated host. So what is a parasite? What is a pathogen? It is a different genotype that has found itself intentionally in the midst of a genotype that is not identical to it. And so as a consequence, there's genetic variation. Now, technically, this is not natural selection because we're talking about two different species at this point. But nevertheless, there is a conflict that exists because you've got two different genotypes occupying the same space. And those genotypes are at least potentially going to be in competition with one another or in conflict with one another. And in the case of parasites or pathogens, it's in conflict. And the same is to a degree true, even if the individuals are the same species, but differ in their genotype. If they are occupying the same location, they are going to be in competition with one another and potentially in conflict with one another. Natural selection is going to be able to distinguish between the two different genotypes. So once you have different genotypes, suddenly you have the potential for natural selection creating a destabilization of, for example, the potential for cooperative behavior between individuals. Multicelled organisms have evolved a variety of mechanisms that cause genetically identical cells to act cooperatively. So it's best that we start with genetically identical cells, but there are different layers that are built upon that that assure that cooperation continues into the future. They also have evolved mechanisms that serve to prevent non-genetically identical cells from acting not cooperatively. Finally, they, or rather we, have evolved mechanisms that serve to prevent non-genetically identical cells from arising or invading at all. The key is to keep the cells as genetically identical as we can, and to also assure that otherwise, regardless, the cells have incentive to act cooperatively. So these various counter-defection mechanisms include individual cell replicant restraint, or replicative restraint. So what this means is that the cells impose upon themselves a restraint on their own replication. They are attempting to be economical rather than expedient. They try to be cooperators rather than defectors. And this comes about as a consequence of their own genes acting upon their own phenotype, causing those cells to display restraint, for example, in their population growth. We also have mechanisms that combat mutation. We talked about this way back when at the beginning of the term. Proofreading enzymes, for example, are a means by which cells reduce their own mutation rate. We start off babies with one or at best a few cells. Typically it's one cell. We have two gametes that fuse and we form a single cell, a zygote. And then that zygote via asexual replication, that is mitosis in eukaryotes and binary fission in bacteria, then give rise to a multi-celled individual that, except for mutation or invasion by parasites, is genetically homogeneous. We also have immune systems, and these control our own body cells. So if our own body cells go rogue, start down the path towards forming tumors or cancer cells, we have means of interfering with that progress. And of course, we also use our immune system to minimize the potential for cheaters from without, for parasites to be able to take advantage of our otherwise cooperating cells to take advantage of the functionality of our bodies towards their own end rather than our own reproductive potential. And then finally, we have a requirement for functionality in baby-generating tissue. And this is a way of effectively testing the waters, the genetic waters, prior to gamete production, or even following gamete production. We have basically set things up so that they're not as cushy as they possibly could be for our cells and our gametes and our zygotes and our offspring. so that these offspring have to struggle at least a little bit and thereby prove their worth before they can continue on in their development, and as a consequence use up more of our resources. A great number of the embryos that form within, well, within women's bodies, I can't say my own body, do not make it through to the point of their full gestation and then birth. And this is because they are not viable for various reasons. And one way of interpreting that is that the lack of viability represents some sort of defect on their part that interferes with their ability to continue onward to the point of exiting the mother's body. And as a consequence of that, we are able to cut our losses early on. And in fact, the number of fertilized eggs that don't survive presumably is much larger than the number of embryos that don't survive. And certainly the number of gametes that don't survive is vastly greater than the number of fertilized eggs that don't survive. And in fact, starting babies from only a single cell actually serves as a cancer-fighting strategy, because we're eliminating our defectors from the start. And in fact, helps explain to some degree why older people are typically more prone to cancer than our younger people. We don't make our babies starting with somatic cells that have become cancerous. Instead, we do everything we can to make sure that our offspring are as genetically intact, as genetically effective as we can succeed in doing. To initiate the next generation, we bottleneck it so that the individuals that result are the product of just a single cell. And if that cell has a genotype that can give rise to a high level of functionality and future reproductive success, then they will be more likely to be evolutionarily successful. And if the genotype of those cells do not give rise to a high level of functionality or potential for reproductive success, then you will see a loss of those genotypes from the population.